Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is For the Record program number 304, titled Illegal Procedure, Organized Crime in the National Football League. Many listeners may be wondering why in the world I'm even dealing with this subject. This, along with program number 301, Mickey Mauschwitz, The Reactionary Politics of Walt Disney, is, in effect, about the politics of illusion. In fact, the two could be called companion pieces. It's about the politics of illusion, and I think my motivation in discussing this will be made apparent. I hope it'll be made apparent by reading a section of the introduction to the book, which is going to provide the substance of all of this broadcast. It's a very important, although largely overlooked, book by Dan E. Moldea, M-O-L-D-E-A, or Moldea. It's called Interference, How Organized Crime Influences Professional Football. It was published in hardcover by William Morrow & Company, and copyright 1989. The ISBN number is 0-688-08303-X. And in the introduction to this book, there's a discussion of Ronald Reagan and his nickname, the Gipper, which he got from playing George Gipp, a Notre Dame football star, in the movie Newt Rockne All-American. And what we're going to be doing in this program, and I want to stress that I couldn't even begin to discuss all of the many evidentiary tributaries running between organized crime and professional football, I'm going to focus on some of the connections between some of the major owners of professional football and not only organized crime, but specifically the organized crime milieu that also overlaps Watergate and the assassination of President Kennedy. Not that organized crime killed President Kennedy, but there's certainly organized crime was one of the elements involved in killing President Kennedy, and I'm going to be placing particular emphasis on some of those mob connections. In the prologue to Interference, Dan Moldea writes as follows. Years before he became President of the United States, actor Ronald Reagan portrayed Notre Dame's George Gipp in the 1940 Warner Brothers movie Newt Rockne All-American. Gipp had died of pneumonia in December of 1920 after an illustrious college football career. His purported deathbed request to Rockne, "Win just one for the Gipper," unquote, was used during a locker room pep talk and helped to inspire Rockne's 1928 team in its upset victory against Army. And as the Gipper incarnate, Reagan used the line to inspire voters to elect him to the California Governor's Mansion and later the White House. To those who saw the movie and listened to Reagan utter those now famous words, Gipp epitomized the virtues of good character, sportsmanship, and the right way of living, unquote. History, however, now shows that Gipp, a man of truly questionable moral values, probably never made any such request on or off his deathbed. That Rockne, who was known for grasping at anything to incite his players, had fabricated the incident, and that Reagan's movie further embellished the Gipp-Rockne charade. Hollywood, which is notorious for cooking up such fantasies as the Gipp-Rockne story, realizes that most Americans view sports as a vehicle of inspiration and entertainment. Thus, sports history is routinely manipulated. Left unquestioned, stories like that of the Gipper become permanent fixtures of Americana. Regardless of the facts, the American public continues to believe the legend of George Gipp's deathbed request to Newt Rockne. The difficulties in debunking the myth about one college coach and one of his players is an indication of the problems in dispelling the legends about an entire institution, particularly one as popular as football. Powerful forces in America have built empires around these myths, and the preservation of these empires and the personal wealth of those who own them depend upon the maintenance of the legends. In the Reagan movie myth of the lives of Rockne and Gipp, there is one scene in which Rockne chases away a gambler who's looking for an edge. Rockne, played by actor Pat O'Brien, tells him, quote, "We haven't got any use for gamblers around here. You've done your best to ruin baseball and horse racing. This is one game that's clean, and it's going to stay clean," unquote. Considering that Gipp, with the knowledge of Rockne, was a notorious sports gambler, the O'Brien quote perhaps best illustrates my point. To a large degree, the National Football League, the NFL, has become the embodiment of the Gipp-Rockne myth. It has wrapped itself around the American flag and strutted into America's homes to the thrilling stir of brass and percussion music as the choreography of bone-crushing tackles in dramatic slow motion flashes across the nation's television screens. Based upon the illusion, the country's love affair with professional football has given sports fans confidence that the NFL is an institution unencumbered by corruption. And noting again what Newt Rockne said, or Pat O'Brien, playing Newt Rockne, said in the movie, "We haven't got any use for gamblers around here. You've done your best to ruin baseball and horse racing. This is one game that's clean and is going to stay clean." And the following anecdote concerns George Gipp, the football player whom Reagan played in Newt Rockne All-American. Grantland Rice, by the way, was arguably the most important or best-known sports writer of his day. Grantland Rice often told a story about an incident that occurred during the halftime of a 1920 game just before Gipp's death of pneumonia. Rice reported that he had been told by an assistant coach for the Irish, quote, "Being behind by 3 points, Rock was really laying into the boys. He had about finished, and Gipp, standing nearby, asked me for a drag of my cigarette. Rock looked up and spotted Gipp leaning against the door, his helmet on the back of his head, puffing the cigarette. Rock exploded. 'As for you, Gipp, I suppose you haven't any interest in this game.' 'Listen, Rock,' replied Gipp, 'I've got $500 bet on this game, and I don't aim to blow any $500. Unquote. Rockne said nothing and never disciplined his player who had been gambling on the outcome of his own games. And what we're going to be doing in this program is examining some of the many connections, and we can only scratch the surface in this broadcast, not only between the world of professional football and the world of organized crime, but specifically we're going to take a look at connections between some of the owners of the National Football League teams and the milieu of organized crime and the milieu of big politics, the milieu of Watergate, and the organized crime connections to the assassination of President Kennedy. One of the people who was heavily involved with the National Football League and also the world of Richard Nixon, the world of Watergate, and the world of the assassination of President Kennedy was the owner of the Dallas Cowboys, Clint Murchison. And the Murchison family we looked at in a big, big way in RFA 37 and their involvement with the assassination of President Kennedy, or the milieu of the assassination of President Kennedy. And the Murchisons Jr. and Sr. were heavily involved with organized crime, and Murchison Jr. owned the Dallas Cowboys. Of the Murchisons' connections to the milieu of Joe McCarthy and Richard Nixon, Dan Moldea writes, "The Murchisons were enthusiastic supporters of Senator Joseph McCarthy's witch hunt and major backers of Vice President Richard Nixon in his 1960 presidential campaign against John Kennedy. After Nixon lost the election, he bought a lot from the Murchisons in Beverly Hills for the bargain price of $35,000. And of some of the many connections of the Murchisons to the milieu of organized crime, the owner of a labyrinth of businesses, the highly secretive Murchison was investigated by no fewer than 9 federal agencies and 2 congressional committees during a 10-year period beginning in 1955. The Senate Commerce Committee wrote that Gerardo Catania of New Jersey, a top-ranking member of the Vito Genovese crime family, quote, allegedly owned almost 20% of all the production of Murchison Oil Lease Company, Oklahoma, during the 1950s. Murchison was also involved in business partnerships with numerous associates of Carlos Marcello of New Orleans, the most feared mafia boss in the South. And Murchison personally had real estate and banking ties with Marcello. Although Murchison had always denied knowing Marcello, he did admit that he occasionally had dinner at the Plantation, Marcello's New Orleans restaurant. Joseph Campisi was a close friend of Murchison. Campisi, the owner of the Egyptian Lounge in Dallas, was associated with numerous underworld figures, particularly Joseph Civello, the head of the Marcello-controlled Dallas Mafia. Campisi has never been convicted of any crime, but was arrested in 1944 for murder. The case was dismissed when the county grand jury determined that he had acted in self-defense. However, he has been linked by law enforcement agencies to Marcello and, quote, with both gambling and bookmaking activities in the Dallas area, unquote. An employee of the Dallas Cowboys told my associate William Scott Malone, quote, Joe Campisi comes by the office on a regular basis, and whenever he does enter the headquarters of the Dallas Cowboys, everyone seems to bow to him. He can go in and out of any office he wants, and everyone is just sort of thrilled to see him. During draft time, he brings by dinner because everyone works late getting ready for the draft. He supplies pizza and so forth for the general office staff. He is considered part of the Cowboy family, unquote. And then Dan Moldeo goes on to talk about Murchison's connections to Irving Davidson, also connected to the Dallas Cowboys. Murchison also hired Washington lobbyist Irving Davidson to handle public relations for one of his companies. Davidson had often boasted that he was a, quote, door opener and arranger, unquote, for Marcello. Prior to buying the Cowboys, Murchison had considered buying the San Francisco 49ers, and when that failed, made George Marshall a bid for the Redskins. Still later we're going to hear about Eddie DeBartolo Sr. and Jr., their connections to the milieu of organized crime. Of course, Eddie DeBartolo recently had to transfer ownership of the San Francisco 49ers to his sister after he was involved in a gambling investigation in Louisiana. In a footnote to the passage I just read you, there's further discussion of the aforementioned Joseph Campisi. Appendix to the Select Committee on Assassinations, U.S. Congress, House of Representatives, 95th Congress, 2nd Session, March 1979, Volume 9, page 335. Campisi was also known as being a friend of Jack Ruby, the murderer of John Kennedy's assassin. Ruby had dinner at Campisi's restaurant the night before the president's murder. Also, 5 days after Ruby killed Lee Harvey Oswald, he called Campisi and asked to see him. Campisi, his wife, and Ruby met privately in the Dallas County Jail on November 30th, 1963. And still more about Clint Murchison and his connections to the world of organized crime. And again, Clint Murchison was the owner of the Dallas Cowboys. The Fincher here is a fellow named Richard Fincher, who's a Miami Oldsmobile dealer and also a very, very prominent Florida gambler, and had ties to a milieu involving major organized crime figures and narcotics dealers. Fincher had also been a business partner of President Richard Nixon's banker friend, B.B. Rebozo, and Michael O'Neill, the owner of General Tire and Rubber Company in the development of Loomis Island, a subsidiary of Fisher Island Incorporated in South Florida. Responsible for building a causeway between Fisher Island and the Florida mainland was Clint Murchison, the owner of the Dallas Cowboys. And skipping down, in a report of an investigation being conducted by the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms of the Department of Treasury, special agents had learned that, quote, Murchison was fronting for organized crime out of Florida at Tony Roma's place for ribs in Dallas. By the way, remember B.B. Rebozo and his connections to Richard Fincher and also through Fisher Island to Clint Murchison. We're going to come back to B.B. Rebozo later on in the program. Beginning again, in a report of an investigation being conducted by the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms of the Department of Treasury, special agents had learned, quote, that Murchison was, quote, fronting, unquote, for organized crime out of Florida at Tony Roma's place for ribs in Dallas. The ATF reported that, again quoting, Murchison is indeed partners with Tony Roma, real name Anthony Lopresti, and past manager of Playboy clubs in Chicago, Montreal, and Montreal, Canada, unquote. Roma had been registered at Acapulco Towers at the same time that the 1970 mobster conference was being held there. The report also linked Murchison with Ettore Zappi, a capo in the Carlo Gambino crime family in New York. From data presently available, the ATF report concluded, it appears that Murchison is firmly entrenched with individuals who are proven national mafia figures, unquote. Murchison's name was also dragged into a major financial scam in which $2 million in Teamsters insurance premiums were diverted to several organized crime operations. Among those insurance companies implicated in the scheme was National American Life Insurance Company. The owner of that firm was a close business associate of Carlos Marcello. Murchison was later named as a member of National American's board of directors along with Joseph Hauser, a convicted insurance swindler who was trying to secure a major insurance contract with the Teamsters Central State Health and Welfare Fund. Also implicated in the scheme was Washington lobbyist and Marcello associate I. Irving Davidson. On October 31, 1977, Davidson gave a sworn deposition in the case. His attorney was Plato Cacheras, the law partner of former NFL security chief Bill Hundley. Plato Cacheras later represented a number of figures in the Iran-Contra scandal. I believe Robert McFarlane was one of them. He also represented Monica Lewinsky in the Whitewater investigation, or basically in the impeachment case against Bill Clinton. By the way, Bill Clinton's attorney, Charles C. Ruff, is a name we're going to hear later in the broadcast as well. Skipping down, more about I. Irving Davidson, a close associate of Clint Murchison, the owner of the Dallas Cowboys. Davidson needed a favor and asked Hauser to help, not knowing that Hauser had been flipped by the government. Hauser responded by bringing the two undercover agents to the meeting, and they asked Davidson to introduce them to Marcello. They explained that they needed the underworld boss in order to obtain major insurance contracts in Louisiana. In addition to wiring Hauser, an electronic surveillance device had been placed in the ceiling above Marcello's desk. During the conversations, according to federal agents, Murchison's name was picked up numerous times on tape because Davidson had served as a go-between for the NFL team owner and Marcello. Murchison and Marcello were involved in negotiations for the sale of a portion of Marcello's estate, Churchill Farms. In the midst of Hauser's tapings of Marcello, in which he made a thinly veiled admission that he had arranged the 1963 murder of President John Kennedy, Murchison's name was brought up several times in connection with a wide range of business deals. The tapes detail Davidson's role as a go-between for Marcello and Murchison on a land deal and a bank purchase the two men were negotiating. The FBI sting operation became known as Bri-Lab, which had broadened into an investigation of bribery of labor union officials and politicians in Arkansas, Kansas, Louisiana, Oklahoma, and Texas. Davidson, who was indicted in the Bri-Lab case along with Marcello and three others, admitted that he had introduced FBI sting man Hauser to Marcello and vouched for him. However, Davidson was acquitted. Marcello was later convicted and finally sent back to prison. At the mob boss's sentencing hearing, a federal judge told Marcello, quote, "You've led a life of crime. The record shows that. By any evaluation, I think it's fair to say you're a bad man," unquote. Murchison was neither prosecuted nor investigated further. There was also no known investigation of Murchison by the NFL. Another NFL owner had proven that he could maintain a direct link to a major organized crime figure without any reprisals from the league. And we're going to come across the name of Bebe Rebozo, other links to the world of Richard Nixon, and also remember the name Plato Cacheras, because we're going to come across the name of his opposite number in the impeachment proceedings about Bill Clinton, Charles C. Ruff, in just a couple of minutes. The next name that we're going to look at concerns Hugh Culverhouse. Now, Hugh Culverhouse became the owner of the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, and as we're going to see, there is a very incestuous relationship between many of these owners who in turn have connections to the milieu of organized crime. We're going to take a look at connections between Hugh Culverhouse, the owner of the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. He, by the way, was the attorney for Bebe Rebozo. We're going to take a look at his role in helping to secure the San Francisco 49ers for Eddie DeBartolo Sr. and Jr., and we're also going to take a look at the role of Al Davis in helping to swing the 49er deal for the DeBartolos. Al Davis, of course, is the owner of the Oakland Raiders. In Interference, Dan Moldea talks about Culver House, his connections to the milieu of organized crime and to the milieu of Watergate, he writes as follows. The delay between Culver House's purchase of the Buccaneers in 1974 and its first NFL game in 1976 resulted from the renovation of Tampa Stadium, which increased its seating capacity from 46,500 to 72,000. According to a member of the Buccaneers, Tampa mob boss Santos Trafficante may have played a key role in the negotiations over the stadium with or without Culver House's knowledge. The player quoted a top member of the Buccaneers' front office as saying, quote, "You can't do anything in this town without Trafficante's approval. In fact, if it wasn't for Trafficante, we wouldn't have this team," unquote. Trafficante was among the most powerful mafia figures in America. He controlled Florida's narcotics network and gambling operations, particularly the Bolita Lottery, a Cuban numbers game. A protege of Meyer Lansky, Trafficante was Lansky's principal enforcer in the crime syndicate's Cuban gambling establishments in pre-Castro Cuba. After Castro overthrew the Cuban government and closed the casinos, Trafficante was arrested and held in custody. Soon after his release and return to the United States, he was recruited by the CIA for his participation in the CIA mafia plots to assassinate Castro. He was also a close friend and business partner with Carlos Marcello of New Orleans. Although there is no further evidence of a connection between Trafficante and the Tampa Bay team, there is a strong connection between Trafficante's mentor, Meyer Lansky, and Culver House. By the way, note that Trafficante's name also cropped up in connection with the assassination of President Kennedy and in connection with the Iran-Contra scandal. We took a look at that in The Guns of November, Part 1, and his involvement allegedly with the Iran-Contra scandal in RFA number 29. But I would also note that Hugh Culver House was the attorney for Bebe Rebozo during the Watergate hearings. Now, Bebe Rebozo, in turn, was a partner with Richard Fincher, and who, in turn, was connected to Clint Murkison, the owner of the Dallas Cowboys. A brief note here about Bebe Rebozo, turning to a slightly different context. In the book Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile by Paul Manning, published in hardcover in 1981, by Lyle Stewart Incorporated, there's discussion of Bebe Rebozo and his role as one of the banking vehicles for the Bormann organization, with or without his knowledge. Paul Manning writes, "The South American group also had direct access to the Nixon White House through their representatives in Washington, and were proud of the fact that Bebe Rebozo was President Nixon's closest friend. For knowingly or unknowingly, Rebozo processed millions of their dollars through his Florida bank as part of normal commercial operations." And again, during Watergate, it was Hugh Culver House who was Bebe Rebozo's attorney. Speaking of Culver House, Dan Moldea writes in Interference, "Culver House represented Bebe Rebozo during the Watergate hearings. His son, attorney Hugh Culver House Jr., was on the legal team headed by William Hundley, former chief of NFL security, that defended former Attorney General John Mitchell during his prosecution for Watergate-related crimes. Also a real estate developer in Florida, Indiana, and Ohio, Culver House became a director of Major Realty, a Florida-based real estate company. Another director was George Smathers of Florida, who was a member of the U.S. Senate while serving on the board." By the way, Mary Jo Kopechne had been his secretary, the woman who died in the Chappaquiddick incident with Ted Kennedy. Continuing, "Major Realty had been a frequent target of federal investigations during the 1960s and 1970s because so many of its investors, attorneys, lenders, and clients had ties to Florida mobsters, especially Meyer Lansky and Santos Trafficante. A confidential 1978 report prepared by the Florida Department of Law Enforcement, FDLE, emphasized that, quote, Major Realty has had a past history of organized crime associations, unquote. Max Orovitz, who founded Major Realty in 1961, was one of Lansky's closest friends and business associates. He had been a partner of Carol Rosenblum and Lou Chesler and had replaced Chesler as the president of the General Development Corporation in 1965. 3 years later, Orovitz was convicted in New York for violations of federal stock registration laws. Another key player in Major Realty was financier Benjamin Siegelbaum, who was responsible for providing loans to the real estate company and keeping it afloat in 1966. He was also identified in a Florida Department of Law Enforcement report as, quote, the financial investor for Meyer Lansky, in other words, a bagman. Implicated in the Bobby Baker scandal, Siegelbaum had been convicted of bankruptcy fraud in 1936. 22 years later, President Eisenhower gave him a full pardon. However, the State of Israel subsequently rejected Siegelbaum's application for citizenship because of his close association with Lansky. After years of selling Florida land at a loss, Major Realty finally announced a profit in 1968 based on the sale of 175 acres of land for $3,500,000. The news caused its stock to jump from 11 cents a share to $14 a share during a 20-month period. The SEC moved in to probe the transaction. At the close of its investigation, the agency called the land sale, quote, a mere fiction designed to create the illusion of profits or value as a basis for sale of securities, unquote. Culver House was not personally accused of any wrongdoing. Now remember the association between the milieu of Meyer Lansky and the milieu of Tampa Bay owner Hugh Culverhouse. Remember the name Major Realty. We're going to come back and to an investigation of who bought Major Realty or who acquired it later. And remember also the many connections here between the milieu of organized crime, the milieu of the NFL, Watergate, and the assassination of President Kennedy and also Richard Nixon. Hugh Culverhouse was the attorney for B.B. Rebozo during the hearings, and Hugh Culverhouse Jr. was part of the legal team headed by William Hundley, the former chief of NFL security, who was also a law partner of Plato Cacheras, who later represented principals in the Iran-Contra scandal, and after he split from Bill Hundley. By the way, I believe his representation of Iran-Contra principles was after he went into practice with somebody other than Hundley. But Plato Cacheras, who later was Monica Lewinsky's attorney, was a partner of Hundley at this time, and Hundley headed the team that represented John Mitchell, the Attorney General, during Watergate. We're going to continue with an examination of the milieu between organized crime, the NFL, and in particular NFL owners in the second half of this broadcast. However, this is going to wrap things up for Side 1. All of the various tapes that I've produced over the years are available from a tape duplication service called Spitfire. That's one word, S-P-I-T-F-I-R-E. You can reach them at P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, 95005. Their email is mail, M-A-I-L, at spitfirelist.com. There's a list of and description of the various tapes available from Spitfire on the Spitfire website at spitfirelist.com. There will be a detailed and annotated description of For the Record program number 304 in the For the Record section of the Spitfire website by the time this program goes out to the member stations that carry it. Sister station WFMU-FM in Jersey City, New Jersey, is now compiling the For the Record programs on Real Audio. There are links in the For the Record section of the Spitfire website to both URLs for sister station FMU that are stockpiling the For the Record programs on Real Audio Archives. One of those web addresses is wfmu.org/Dave Emory, DaveEmory. And there's a longer URL that has some of the older For the Record programs on Real Audio file as well. There's a link to that in the For the Record section. Actually, there's a link to both FMU websites in the For the Record section of the Spitfire website. You can email me at my home base station, KFJC-FM, at DEMORY@KFJC.org. That concludes For the Record program number 304, Side A, Illegal Procedure, organized crime in the National Football League. This is being recorded on May 16th of the year 2001. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.